Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Salmon are the principal iconic species here in the Pacific Northwest, but once salmon were iconic for all northern latitude countries around the world. As we watch the once abundant salmon runs dwindle in the few remaining places where they have thrived over the past century, we are actually witnessing the same processes that previously wiped out salmon runs across northern Europe and the American Northeast, the impacts of overfishing and industrial pollution. Today we talk with Mark Kolanski, author of Salmon, A Fish, the Earth, and the History of a Common Fate, about how the fate of salmon is intimately connected with the fate of all life on this planet. Mark, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you.
Well, I want to start with a very large question, which is based on the vast scope of the title of your book, which is Salmon, A Fish, the Earth, and the History of a Common Fate. So I thought we could begin with the big picture, which how are the fates of the Earth and salmon connected?
Well, because a salmon lives part of its life in the ocean and part of its life in the rivers, it is affected by the ecology of the whole Earth. I mean, what's going on land and what's going on in the sea. And when you look at the problems facing the salmon, they are the problems facing the Earth. And I always say that all we have to do to save the salmon is save the planet.
Well, we're very familiar here in the Pacific Northwest about the importance of salmon, and salmon is the iconic species of the Pacific Northwest. I grew up in New England, where salmon were basically almost gone by the time I was growing up.
I grew up in Hartford, but my family was from Boston, and I knew nothing about salmon. Nobody ate salmon. Many years later, I learned that the Connecticut River was one of the great salmon rivers of North America.
Well, it kind of blew my mind when I learned that from your book, but what blew my mind even more was the extensive salmon runs in Europe back until the industrial age kind of killed them. I want to talk about what we can learn from the ancient salmon runs that were all over Northern Europe up until the industrial age, and the lessons we can learn from what happened to them as we're trying to protect the remaining runs in the Pacific Ocean.
I mean, what I learned from doing this book, from the whole historic perspective, in ancient times, people were aware that they had to protect the rivers to protect the salmon. And there were laws about protecting salmon rivers and protecting salmon runs. And in the Middle Ages, there were a lot, including the Magna Carta, which restricted the King of England from blocking English rivers that had salmon. This was all a struggle, and they didn't do things as well as they might have. But the real crisis came with the Industrial Revolution. Because the power of the rivers could power plants. You built plants by the rivers. You know the story from New England. You build plants by the river, you dam the river, you power the plant, and then the plant dumps pollution back into the river. And after not that much time, the great rivers of Britain were basically dead. Then, if you look at New England, it's the exact same story. Often, ironically, people of British origin, damming the rivers to power mills, the mills polluting, and soon most of the great rivers of New England were dead. And then you look at the Pacific Northwest. The Pacific Northwest had very little economic activity from, you know, the industrial perspective. And then there was this great idea that you could build these dams and create a huge amount of energy. This was considered a wonderful thing. You know, Woody Guthrie wrote a song about damming the Columbia, isn't this great? And did a pretty good job of killing those rivers. So as I'm studying this whole history, I started asking myself, how come nobody's ever learning anything? And then I realized something important, because they're not trying to learn anything. The people who did these things considered them great successes. I mean, they made Britain the star of the Industrial Revolution. They made New England the greatest industrial power of North America. They took the Pacific Northwest, which had nothing going on, and turned it into this economic powerhouse. These are great success stories. So what you learn from all this is that our whole concept of economic development is completely wrong. It's a thing that is often said, usually, not always, by Republicans, that, you know, these ideas of saving rivers and other environmental measures also are, you know, they're just going to cost jobs, they're going to take away people's jobs and destroy the economy. This is such wrong thinking. There's nothing written that says economic activity has to be destructive. You have to rethink how you develop economy. If you look at Native Americans, the traditional way of looking at Native Americans is that, yeah, they had salmon and they fished it. The salmon runs did just fine because they weren't very good fishermen and didn't catch much, and they didn't know enough to sell the stuff anyway. This is all complete fantasies. They were extremely skillful fishermen, so much so that, you know, when European Americans went to the Pacific Northwest, you know, Lewis and Clark were hungry. They would go to Native Americans, say, get us some salmon. They didn't know how to do it, but the natives did. They definitely saw it as a commercial product, you know, Chinook. Why do we call a king salmon Chinook? After the Chinook, who were a people who commercialized Chinook salmon to native peoples all over the Northwest. But they didn't destroy the salmon because their concept of their economy, and I'm not saying we have to reproduce their economy, but their concept of their economy is that you can't do anything to destroy the rivers because that's the basis of the economy. Also, in native religions, food, animals like salmon, they come to us as a gift. And, you know, you have to treat a gift respectfully. We don't have to necessarily copy all these things, but it's just an example of viewing economic development in a way that isn't destructive.
Well, last week I did a show about beaver, and we were talking about the importance of protecting beaver habitat and bringing beaver back onto the landscape because of all the benefits that they provided for, among other creatures, salmon, but of course for all of us. And the person I was talking to, Suzanne Foudy, who's a hydrologist, when I asked her, like, what was the principal thing we could learn from beaver, she said generosity, because we thrive on this landscape because of the generosity of beaver, because they're not building their dams just for themselves. They're doing it for all the species that live there. And I wonder if you could talk about the difference of the perspective of a beaver compared to the industrialists that have really destroyed so many salmon runs around the world.
I don't know that I can pretend to know what's on the mind of a beaver, but, you know, the reason why the ecology, the reason why nature works is because animals have their role in nature. You know, it's Darwinian. If it doesn't work, they don't survive. If it does work, they prosper. That's natural selection. And we have somehow gotten out of natural selection. We're doing things that don't lend themselves to survival. And if you read your Darwin, you know where that ends. We don't survive.
What was really mind-blowing to me in reading your book was how important salmon were to all the cultures of Europe before they extirpated the salmon. And it reminds me, a number of years ago, I was interviewing a couple of people up in the Olympic Peninsula about salmon. And the woman gave me this coin, which is an Irish coin. And on one side, there's a harp. And on the other side, there's a salmon. And she was telling me how important salmon were to the Irish. I guess they still are, even though there's no salmon rivers in Ireland anymore. And let's talk about the salmon that have continued to survive in Europe. And then I want to talk about the important role that they played before they were extirpated.
I fish in Ireland. I fly fish for salmon in Ireland. So I know that they do have them. I also seldom catch one. So I know they don't have that many. But it's a pretty well-managed system at this point. Far down from what it once was. One of the fascinating things I discovered in doing this book, just a little digression in history. I mean, that's the whole fun of the books I do, is just go off on these little tangents. During the potato famine, when Ireland was starving, they were shipping huge salmon from Irish rivers to the market in London. It's a myth that Ireland didn't have food. They just didn't make it available to the Irish.
What would you say that salmon were no longer available in Europe to the point where people stopped eating them? And before that, was salmon a really important food to the Europeans?
Yeah, it was, and it still is. A lot of it nowadays is farmed. And there's a lot of critical things we can say about farmed salmon. But one positive thing you can say about farmed salmon is in countries like Norway and Scotland and France, where salmon is such an intrinsic part of the culture, they have accepted closing down commercial fisheries because they had farmed salmon available. So these people are still eating salmon.
Though to me, it's kind of questionable. I've had a little bit of farmed salmon myself, and some of it I really wonder what its relationship is to real salmon. And that can get us into the whole life cycle of salmon.
That's the least of the problems, but I personally just much prefer, you know, wild salmon. But there's an interesting thing that's happening. It's like game. You know, in this country, until after the Civil War, most of the meat that people ate was game. And over the decades of the late 19th century into the 20th century, Americans have gotten used to eating domestic meat. And what's happened? They like it better because it's fatter, it's milder, you know, it doesn't have that gamey flavor, it's just milder and it's more tender and fatter. And that's exactly what's happening with salmon. I mean, I talk to people all the time who prefer farmed salmon. And they say, you know, it's milder tasting. I like the way it's fatty. They're talking about it just like domestic meat versus wild meat.
Well, do you think that there's something that's lost there? Because to me, something about eating wild salmon, there's a wild gene in there that it's going into your body.
I mean, I would rather eat game than domestic meat, beef too. But it's something that's happening to people's taste.
Well, I guess that gets us back to this whole saga about the important role that salmon play on so many levels in our lives and on the planet. But one of them to me is really that connection to wildness, the whole idea of the way that salmon can jump. They can jump over rapids and jump over small waterfalls.
And a salmon is one of the most incredible animals in nature. I mean, they can jump 10 and 11 feet. I've seen them do it. You may have too. You can't figure out how they do it. You know, they don't have any legs. What are they pushing off against? They just shoot up there. And the whole life cycle, the fact that they travel thousands of miles to find the river of their birth and then, you know, get back to the exact place of their birth without eating, because if they ate, there'd be nothing left of the river. The whole life cycle of salmon is poetic and fantastic. And the things that they can do physically, I mean, I'm told that they accelerate faster than a car. And I get challenged on this and I get into trouble because I'm a New Yorker and I don't know anything about cars. I don't own one, you know. But people who know cars tell me that a salmon can accelerate faster than a car. They're just this unbelievable physical specimen. And the whole mating ritual and the transformation of all of them, I mean, most spectacularly the sockeye, but all of them, you know, growing these humps and this bright red color. You know, the color is the pigment from their flesh. And they push it out onto the skin, which is why a spawned salmon has white flesh. And, you know, getting to this place and spawning is using every last ounce of energy they have, which is why they die. And one of the things they spend a tremendous amount of energy on is this transformation. And it's a very strange thing. Darwin wrote about it in The Descent of Man, because it was very central to Darwin's thinking that things in nature happen for a reason. He said, what could possibly be the reason for this? What purpose does it serve? And in time, he came to realize that it was to sexually attract females, which, you know, in Victorian England, this was the There are many unpopular things about Darwin, but in Victorian England, this was the most unpopular thing. But, you know, you look at this sockeye, this misshapen, and its mouth is turned up, and its hooked nose, and this hump, and the garish color. And it reminds me of, you know, you see this guy in this bright plaid suit, and you say, oh, my God, why are you dressed like this? And he says, oh, the girls really like it. But they do.
Well, I want to let you know that you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. Today we're talking with Mark Kolanski, who's author of Salmon, A Fish, The Earth, and The History of a Common Fate. When we start talking about the life cycle of salmon, and you're describing just, you know, the incredible uniqueness and power of the species, but I also feel like there's this connection that we get when we are able to go and watch salmon spawn, which until the Eagle Creek fire in 2017, which destroyed the woods above this incredible salmon spawning area, and it's been off limits just about every year since the fire. But I used to go there every year and watch the salmon spawn, and it was just an amazing amount of energy. And I wonder if you can describe what it's like when they are actually spawning, what the females do, what the males do, and what it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. I had the good fortune to be invited by a biologist in the University of Washington to his cabin in Alaska. Horrible place, you know, no water, no electricity. But you could go out and get to the spawning area, just be in the middle of it, really. And you know what it reminded me of? Reminded me of when I was a kid, we used to go out west and we'd go to rodeos like Frontier Day in Cheyenne, Wyoming. And when the rodeo comes to town, it's like everybody's out there and they're sort of milling around and checking each other out. And that's kind of what it's like. I mean, before they actually spawn, they're just kind of swimming around, checking each other out. They're all out there, you know, bright red. They're in such shallow water that their dorsal fins are sticking up like flags. And it's an incredible sight. The thing is, when you watch this, you realize that this is it. This is the most exciting moment in their lives, preparing for their death, really. But I mean, it's such an unbelievable, it's like a Greek story, you know, it's like a Greek tragedy.
Well, I also understand that the Atlantic salmon didn't always die when they spawned, that they would return to their home river like more than once.
The majority die, but some do some do make it back, and they stay in the river for a long time, gathering enough strength and getting enough health back so they can go out in the ocean again. They're really kind of sad looking fish for a while till they're ready to go out to sea again.
Well, what is said about the Pacific salmon, and this is a lot, I've heard this from indigenous people, that they gave their lives to rebuild the landscape of the Pacific Northwest after the glaciers retreated, because there was nothing here except glacial till. And the salmon came back, and you can find their, you can find actually the nitrogen and carbon compounds in trees that are marine compounds, not terrestrial compounds. And that comes from the salmon.
And also, I mean, the rivers depend on dying salmon for nutrients.
Now, was this true? Like, I mean, this is the Northwest legend, is basically the salmon gave their lives so we have one of the most verdant places in the world now with our rainforests and amazing landscape. But I just wonder if that was also true in Europe. I mean, were the salmon responsible for creating the landscape of Europe and the ecological health of it?
The life of the river and by extension, the life of the bank and so on. I mean, certain bird life and certain mammal life, you know, they're just very important to the whole web of life. And part of that is the salmon who die in the river. I mean, if the salmon didn't die in the river, if they all went to sea, which doesn't happen, the rivers wouldn't survive. And the salmon actually wouldn't survive. They're dying in the river. It's part of their life cycle.
When the salmon dies in the river, what is that giving to the river?
Well, they decompose in the river, and these are very important nutrients. also they provide food for bears and eagles. And I mean, you can see it in the Pacific Northwest when the salmon are spawning. I mean, the bears coming down to the rivers and the eagles swooping down.
Actually, in British Columbia, there's a whole group of wolves that also are salmon dependent, and they go down to when the salmon are spawning and feast, and they just eat the heads because they're smart enough to know that the rest of the salmon is not good for them. We'll give them salmon.
Well, you know, this is a controversy between animals. The seals think that the only worthwhile part is the belly, which really angers salmon fishermen. I've had this experience. Actually, I write about it in the opening of my book. I was out on a commercial salmon boat and gill netting. And, you know, we'd been out all night at sea waiting for the moment to set up the net and start fishing because it's regulated that way. It says at such and such hour you can start fishing. And they actually have aircraft flying overhead to make sure you don't cheat. So it's time to start fishing, and we get our nets out there, and the salmon are hitting the nets. And then four seals show up. And, you know, it's not like they eat salmon after salmon. They just take a bite out of the belly of each one. So if you're only taking one bite per fish, and you can get through a bunch of them really quickly. And there's just nothing you can do about it. It's illegal to try to stop them.
Kind of reminds me of the birds who pick up my blueberries. Just one bite ruins the blueberry. Actually, I wanted to talk a little bit about at the beginning of the book, you talk about kind of a tale of two fisheries. I wonder if you could sort of summarize that in these two very different fisheries that you visited in Alaska.
Yes, both gill netters. You know, in one case, the people I fished with in Bristol Bay. And, you know, it's an interesting thing. One of the interesting things about salmon is that they're very adaptable. So they adapt to whatever rivers they're in. So the salmon from every river are completely different, even if they're the same species. The Chinook in this river are not like the Chinook in the next river. For us, for people who want to eat salmon, what we want is salmon who live in really long, tough rivers. The Copper River being an example of it. The rivers off of Bristol Bay are not an example of it. A very rich salmon run, but salmon that are not nearly as commercially valuable, partly because they don't take good care of them when they fish them, but partly because they just aren't rivers that produce the highest quality of fish. It's also a fishery with very little capital investment. You know, you have these open deck skiffs and nets, and that's about it. And you're out there, the guy I went out with was from Montana. He was a sheep shearer, and every salmon season he'd go up to Alaska and he'd just get a bunch of young guys to go up and fish with him. These guys, you know, had never been to sea before in their life. It was hysterically funny. He'd growl at them, "Okay, you go to the stern," and they look around completely confused, and I sort of quietly pointed the stern so they'd know which way to go. I mean, they knew nothing. And they catch a ton of fish, and they're stepping on them and everything. And then they take them over to these ships and load them. The other fishery that I was doing was, they're actually fishing in the Gulf of Alaska, but it's Copper River salmon. They monitor the fish going up the Copper River, and when they see that enough have gone up for spawning, they give the fishermen permission for a certain number of hours to catch them out at sea, out in the Gulf of Alaska. So you're out in much tougher water with much more evolved boats. You know, it's a boat with a cabin, but one person, not a bunch of guys from Montana. It's like one person per boat, or in my case, two, because the person let me fish with her. You take the fish out of the net, and you cut its gills to bleed it, and you slide it into an ice thing. So completely different than Bristol Bay, and you know they're getting twice as much per pound for a fish.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LP FM and KODX LP FM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Mark Kurlansky, who's the author of Salmon, A Fish, the Earth, and the History of a Common Fate. I want to jump across the Pacific and talk about some of the fisheries that you describe in Russia, in actually Siberia, and in, down into Japan, because these are fisheries that are really related to the salmon fisheries we have on the west coast of North America, but they have a lot of differences too.
If you talk about the Kamchatka Peninsula in Russia, you know, there is, you go there and there is no doubt that there was a land bridge to Alaska, because the native people are so similar to the native people in Alaska. And even the ways they prepare and eat salmon are the same. And, you know, just a very similar culture. And linguists find ties between their languages.
So how about the salmon? Are there ties between the salmon that they're fishing and the salmon that people are fishing in North America?
Science has still not really figured out what happens to salmon when they go to sea. You know, exactly where they go, where a certain group goes and where another group goes. But given the fact that they go out thousands of miles, the Alaskan salmon and probably, you know, Washington salmon are, I always forget about British Columbia, their salmon too, you know, are probably swimming somewhere near where the Russian Kamchatka salmon are swimming, because they all go great distances. You know, I wonder if any of them stray, because salmon do stray sometimes. They don't go back to where they're supposed to. And it's a good thing, because that's how they find and colonize new rivers. And I wonder if they ever, if you ever have a Russian salmon that strays to Alaska or vice versa. I don't think it's known.
One of the things that's amazing is the way that salmon find their way home. And that's another iconic feature of salmon, that salmon in a way embody the whole concept of home. So let's talk about what a salmon does when they're out in the ocean and they've been out there for 2 or 3 or 5 years. How do they find their way back to their home stream?
Well, this also is not really known. I mean, there's a lot of theories. There's some possibility of solar navigation. There's, I mean, first of all, you have to realize that a salmon must have an incredible memory, that, you know, they would have any notion of where to go. I mean, of what they were looking for. They do have magnetic elements to their lateral stripe. And some scientists have theorized that there's some kind of magnetic navigation going on. But it's not entirely known. It is thought that once they do find the right river, they know their home by smell. And they find that spot in the river that they have to return to by smell. Salmon do have a very good sense of smell.
Actually, I was told by a Native American elder of the Skokomish tribe on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington, his name is Bruce Miller, he said that the salmon taste their way down the stream and out into the ocean, and they taste their way back. And he said that with quite a bit of authority. And I just wonder, I haven't heard any Western scientists come up with that.
Well, what does he mean by taste? Taste the water?
They taste the water, yes.
Quite possibly. But it seems to be more that they smell the water.
Of course, taste and smell are kind of connected.
Right. But salmon have a much sharper sense of smell than of taste. But they certainly, you know, they get in the river, they know exactly where they're going. You can see that.
What do you think that we can learn from salmon about the whole understanding of what it means to be home, or what it means to go home?
You know, that's a tricky thing. My daughter's high school graduation, the valedictorian speech, this girl gave this lovely speech about what she had learned from salmon and about how she would always swim home. And I was sitting there thinking, does she know that they go home to have sex and die? I think a more important thing that we learned from salmon is how incredibly complicated and how magical, really, the forces of nature are, and how easily we can destroy this, and how important it is not to destroy it. We're not going to become salmon, and that's okay.
Well, I talked to the director of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission about 20 years ago, and I was doing my first documentary about salmon, and he said that he wasn't too concerned about the salmon surviving. He thought they were going to survive long after people do. And I wonder if that's a thought that you ever have of like that we're really concerned about wiping out salmon, and they have been wiped out from a lot of parts of the world, and yet they do survive. And what can we learn from the way that the salmon survive and maybe learn some ways that might help our own survival as well?
This gets back to what I was talking about in the title. I mean, they're interconnected. It's not really a question of whether we're going to survive or the salmon is going to survive. It's whether the planet will survive. If the planet can survive and support life, it'll support salmon and it'll support humans. But for that to happen, we have to stop deforestation, we have to stop pollution, we have to stop damming, we have to improve agricultural practices. Irrigation is a big issue in a lot of places, especially in Japan. And we have to do something. We have to do something about climate change. Or we aren't going to survive. The salmon isn't going to survive, and we aren't going to survive.
But something that you mentioned in the beginning about the way that people don't learn from the way they've extirpated salmon, that it seems like we have to have a real value shift. And
yes.
How would you see that happening?
Yes, I know. I mean, I'm just sitting here calmly telling you about how we have to rethink economic development. And, I don't think that Joe Biden can, put that on the program for next week. It's a very complicated, deep thing. But we all have to just really change our thinking.
Well, I realized, I think at one point in a really big way, how hard it is for people to wrap their minds around what salmon are really about. Because I remember Obama complaining back several years ago about how there were all these different agencies that had to do with protecting the salmon. Some of them were upriver, some of them were marine, like NOAA. And he didn't understand why there were all these different agencies to protect the salmon. And I heard that and I thought, you don't understand the salmon's life cycle.
Right.
And I think that that's something, I mean, at the time, it was very frustrating, actually, to see the person who was in charge of NOAA, who was an Oregonian and actually should have understood these things. And even she didn't seem to get it as she was up by the Dalles Dam and the Columbia River, basically not making a very strong stand for taking out the Snake River dams. So how do we get people to understand the complexity of the salmon's life history and how that informs the interconnection of everything?
There are some encouraging signs. Polls in the Northwest and also in New England, but especially in the Northwest, show that people are starting to more and more give a priority to this. That there have been polls in Oregon showing that people regard the restoration of salmon as more important than economic development. Now, the point I'm making is it's not either or. You could do both.
How does that look if we were going to do economic development that also was tied in deeply with salmon restoration?
Well, it's really more, things that you... I mean, if you look at climate change, I mean, you just have to reduce carbon emissions. And you have to find ways of doing things. You have to use energy that doesn't... put out carbon emissions. You have to change your whole way of doing things. A guy who's driving an SUV in Indiana has to understand that he's putting out carbon that's going to end up in the ocean. You can't do that. I have been looking recently at programs for inland salmon farming. And there's some interesting things about it that it solves some of the problems of salmon farming, like sea lice and escapes. But I don't think you can do it. And the reason is that it greatly increases the amount of energy you use. It greatly increases the carbon footprint. And no, and this is supposed to be an environmental measure. No environmental measure should be talking about something that increases energy.
Another thing that really bothers me about the inland salmon farming is that you're taking an animal that will swim thousands and thousands of miles, and you're having them swim around this area, which is maybe, what, 2 or 3 miles at the most? Because they're just like a bunch of pools that are connected with these little channels. So let's talk about the contradiction between what the salmon was born to be and what they are going to be living in an inland fish farm.
Well, a pen in the ocean also. I mean, a salmon farmed in the ocean has nothing to do with a wild salmon. But that is the nature of domesticating animals. Oryx that are extinct, the ancestors of cattle, were nothing like cattle. I was going to say wolves are nothing like dogs, but they are a little bit. I see some similarities there. You know, when I take my dog out in the wintertime and she kind of circles in the snow to sit down, and you think, why is she doing that? Because she's a wolf.
I'm actually thinking about, I had this puppy who really loved to, we used to say she was doing the teeth of our next door neighbor's larger dog. And then I learned that actually that's what wolves do. They feed their young by them licking their mouths because they have the food in their mouths. So there's, like, I guess lots of examples of wild animals, the residue of wild animals and the domesticated animals that we know and love.
Oh, really? That's interesting. Because I have a 12-week-old puppy and an 8-year-old dog, and the 12-week-old is constantly licking the mouth of the older dog.
That's the wolf instinct.
Yeah.
I think with salmon, though, for me, what's really hard is, I guess, I don't know how much of this is just romance, but it seems that the salmon have such an incredible life history, even maybe compared to wolves or other wild animals.
Yes.
So we've tried not to extirpate the wolves too. Like, wolves are another species that's very important. So when you wipe out that whole life history and you're going to just farm salmon and you just make salmon be a domestic animal, it seems like you're wiping out a very important part of the Earth's history as well.
There's no substitute. I mean, the idea of replacing wild salmon with farm salmon is a really bad idea, unless you're talking about on the table as food. You know, you can do that, but the proposal was never to, you know, that, okay, we don't need wild salmon anymore because we have farm salmon. It's no kind of a replacement.
Though in Europe, I mean, how much of the salmon runs are still left in Europe, the wild salmon runs?
Well, Atlantic salmon is really in trouble. I get different estimates of, you know, 1.5 million, 2 million, 2.5 million Atlantic salmon left in the world. If you just look at the size of a sockeye run in Bristol Bay, it's many times more than that. So Atlantic salmon are in deep trouble, and a lot of that, you know, a lot of that was blamed on commercial fishing, but commercial fishing has basically been stopped in the Atlantic. The big culprit seems to be climate change. I've talked to river managers in Ireland and Scotland and Norway, and they all say, you know, the fish are spawning in the river, and the young ones are coming out and they're going to sea. And in New England also, they're telling me this, in the Penobscot, where they've been trying to restore the river, they go to sea and they don't come back. They don't come back at nearly the rate that they used to or that they're supposed to. And so I talked to scientists who are studying this at Woods Hole Laboratory and other places, and asked them what's going on, and they said that the food that salmon depend on, also cod and other large fish, capelin, zooplankton, are not growing to the sizes that they used to. And the reason for this is that the carbon in the water has changed the chemical composition of the water so that they're just not, it's not inducive to growth. So What's happening is that the Atlantic Ocean is no longer putting out enough food to feed the animals that live in it. That, I don't know what, 40 years of writing about environmental subjects is about the scariest thing I've ever heard.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN, and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And we're talking today with Mark Kurlansky, who's author of Salmon, A Fish, the Earth, and the History of a Common Fate. Well, I want to get to a more cheerful note for a moment. One of the things that I found surprising in your book was all the recipes for how to prepare and cook salmon. And then I realized that you're a food writer in another life.
Well, I have a thing for recipes. I think that recipes are just these great artifacts that tell you all about a culture and a society and a time in history. And so I love recipes. I put recipes in almost all of my books. I have a book coming out, I don't know when it's coming out, a while from now, about onions. You know, somebody had to do it. I mean, you know, a vegetable that has the gall to spit hydrochloric acid in your eye if you try to touch it, you know, ought to be treated with some kind of respect. And I have, I don't know, maybe 100 recipes in that book from different times and places. But it's, you know, the salmon recipes are to tell you about these places.
I want to talk a bit about that because I was particularly interested in the salmon recipes from the Middle Ages. And this summer, one of my pandemic projects was to read A Distant Mirror by Barbara Tuchman. Uh-huh. And so and there's a lot, actually, she doesn't have recipes in the book, but she talks a lot about the way that they prepare food. So it was interesting to, like, from my little bit of knowledge I gleaned about the Middle Ages from that book, to look at these recipes. And I just want to talk a little bit about what you learned reading these recipes and how you would imagine the culture that surrounded the way they were being done.
Fortunately, people don't realize this, but a lot of cookbooks have survived from the Middle Ages. So we know a lot about how they prepared food. And, you know, one of the things these recipes show us is the patterns of trade. Tremendous amount of spices and things are being used, and saffron. And you can also kind of piece together what peoples were tied with what peoples by commonalities in food and approaches to cooking. You know, it's interesting to see why it is that Celts never built ovens. And so Celtic cooking is on griddles, always. And, you know, all of these things are, you know, they're really keys. Just like looking at native food. And it's interesting to see how much native food, which I'm dealing with salmon, so it's just the coasts, but how much native food in New England and Maritime Canada, how much it has in common with native food in the Northwest and British Columbia and Alaska. Showing that, you know, through the Arctic Circle, these cultures were interconnected.
Well, in the last part of this hour, I want to talk about other ways that we can protect and save the salmon. And one of the encouraging things that's come up in the last few weeks here in the Northwest is that Idaho Representative Mike Simpson is proposing to breach those four Snake River dams that people have been trying to get rid of for at least the last 50 years or more.
What is he proposing to do?
To breach the four Snake River dams, which are really the biggest salmon-killing dams in the whole Columbia River system.
To tear them down.
Yeah, or at least to open them up to so that the fish can migrate.
That's extraordinary. That's extraordinary because that is such a, if you forgive the pun, hot potato in Idaho. because the whole Idaho economy is based on making, you know, inland Idaho a seagoing port, which is only possible because of those dams.
And actually, those dams don't do much in terms of, they don't do much in terms of shipping. I found that out by trying to get a ride all the way to Lewiston, Idaho on a tugboat to cover the story I was doing about the Columbia River. And I was told, well, they don't go up to Lewiston very much. We'll take you up to the Dalles.
Huh. But there are barges that are taking wheat and They used to take lumber. I don't know if they do lumber
anymore. They take actually, they take garbage. The barge, the tugboat that I was on, there was a garbage barge, an oil barge, and those were going up past the Dalles. I think those might be going up to Pasco. And then there was an empty barge that was going to go to the Dalles, and that was going to be where the wheat was piled on. So the wheat was taken by train to the Dalles and then put on barges and taken to the port.
Idaho is now the second largest milk-producing state in the country. And it's because they have all these grains, because they're transporting all this, shipping all this stuff to the coast.
Well, I found it very exciting that this guy,
See how I work. I did a book on milk. That's why I know that. It all gets interconnected.
Well, what to me is really inspiring is that Mike Simpson is actually a Republican. So
of course
this
he
has
is.
Been,
it's
yeah. There used to be Democrats in Idaho, but they don't seem to be making.
Well, there
it very
used
far
to be
anymore.
Democrats because there used to be unions. There used to be mines and lumber mills that were union labor, and that's why that was the Democratic Party.
And they used to have environmental senators like Church, Frank Church. So
yes.
Things have changed a lot. But I think the fact that this is becoming a discussion, and it looks like for the first time, it's being taken really seriously.
Well, I hadn't heard that. That's fantastic.
Just imagine those four dams being gone. Do you think that might be like a paradigm shift for us starting to appreciate a different way to treat the rivers that might bring back the salmon?
Yeah. I mean, there's a whole list of rivers in Northern California and Oregon and all over the Pacific where dams are set to come down or have come down. And it's very encouraging. I find it very hard to believe that the huge hydroelectric dams will ever come down. But, that they're thinking about this stuff and doing this stuff. And, you know, every dam that comes down encourages more dams to come down. But it's extremely expensive. Not only the actual taking down of the dams, especially if they're, what do they call them, gravity dams, these dams that stay in place because they are just this huge pile of concrete. But also, as you see in the Elwha, once you take down the dam, the whole configuration of the place completely changes and you have to sort of get it back to what it was. This is not a simple thing at all. So there's a huge amount of money and commitment that's required for dam removal.
Though I think, particularly around the Klamath River dams, which are also slated to come down, it was a delay during the Trump administration, but it looks like they're going to come down or start coming down the next year. I think that PacifiCorps, who owns the dams, realized it was going to be cheaper to take the dams down than to retrofit them for fish ladders. So I guess raise the economic benefits of salmon restoration, that becomes part of the equation that makes it more.
Yes, that's often the case that dam removal is the cheapest way. If you're committed to saving the salmon, that's the cheapest way to do it.
So are you hopeful that we'll be able to save the salmon and save the earth?
I guess I am. But I think that just has to do with your nature. I think I have a tendency to be unreasonably optimistic. If you write about environmental issues, you have to either have an optimistic streak or, I don't know, a suicidal one or something. I mean, you can't face this stuff unless you see some hope.
So what do you hope? What is your vision for what you see as possible and would be the best way to go?
I think, there's a bunch of things that I think there is going to be more and more dam removal. I think that there's going to be not only a stop to deforestation, but reforestation, replanting of riverbanks. There are projects in Washington and other places to, when they had that first growth forest with those huge trees, and trees would end up in the middle of the river, and the salmon used that as part of their habitat. And now they're just taking wood and logs and chaining them out there in the middle of the river to recreate this habitat, and that's helpful. And they're rethinking farming practices, and a lot of things are being done. A lot more has to be done. They've really handled the whole fishing problem. There's not much overfishing of salmon. But, you know, people don't understand, partly because of me and my book about cod, you know, people get this idea that, you know, the problem with fisheries is overfishing, and if we could just straighten out overfishing, then we would be fine. And, you know, that just isn't true. I mean, if you had a fishery where the only problem was overfishing, that would be great. But there are so many more problems. But the fishing one for salmon is being handled. I mean, it's being almost entirely shut down in the Atlantic and in the Pacific. You know, places like Alaska is a well-regulated fishery. And I have to think that if the Pacific Northwest got their salmon fisheries back, that they wouldn't screw them up. That they would, you know, those fisheries would be well-regulated. Salmon is actually a fairly easy fish to regulate, you know, because it has this very predictable life cycle.
So are you hopeful? Do you think that we're going to muddle through okay?
I guess so. You know, we got rid of Trump. So why not feel hopeful? Yeah. And what's the point of not being hopeful?
Well, Mark, it's really great to talk to you. I want to thank you very much for joining us on Locus Focus today.
Pleasure talking to you.
We've been talking with Mark Kolanski, author of Salmon, A Fish, the Earth, and the History of a Common Fate. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we'll talk about Portland's Industrial Sacrifice Zone with Bob Salinger with Portland Audubon and Mamalang Memela with the Center for Sustainable Economy. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with Cassandra Wilson doing the Waters of March. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask.
A stick, a stone, it's the end of the road. It's a rest of a stump, it's a little alone. It's a sliver of glass, it is life, it's a sun. It is night, it is death, it's a trap, it's a gun. The oak when it blooms, the fox in the brush. The knot in the wood, the song of a thrush. The wind in the wood, a cliff, a fall. A scratch, a lump, it is nothing at all. It's the wind blowing free, it's the end of a slope. It's a beam, it's a void, it's a hunch, it's a hope. And the riverbank talks on the waters of March. It's the end of all strain, the joy in your heart. It's the joy in your heart. The foot, the ground, the flesh and the bone. The bend of the road, a slingshot stone. A fish, a flash, a silvery glow. A fight, a bet, of a bow, the bed of the well, the end of the line, the dismay in your face is a loss, it's a fire, a spear, a spike, a point, a nail, a trip, a drop, the end of a tale, a truckload of bricks in the soft morning light, the sound of a gun in the dead of the night, a mile, a must, a thrust, a bump, it's a girl, it's a rhyme, it's a cold, it's a mumps. The plan of the house, the body in bed, and the car that got stuck. It's the mud, afloat, a drift of light, a wing, a hawk, a quail. The promise of spring and the riverbank chalks are the waters of March, the end of all strain, the joy in your heart. It's the joy in your heart. Snake, a stick, it is John, it is Joe. It's a cut in your hand and a thorn in your toe. A point, a grain, a beat, a bite, a blink, a buzzard, a sudden stroke of night. A pin, a needle, and a sting, a pain. A snake, a riddle, a wasp, a sting. A pass in the mountains, a horse and a mule. In the distance, the shelves brew through shadows of blue. And the riverbank talks of the waters of March. It's the end of all strain in your heart. A stick, a stone, the end of the road. The rest of a stump, a lonesome road. A sliver of glass, a life, a sun, a night, a death. The end of the run, and the riverbank talks of the waters of March. It's the end of all strain, the joy. Talks of the world.